I'd like to welcome everyone to the Haller Lecture. This is the 9th annual Haller Lecture. This lecture was set up in 1998 to honor Archibald Haller, who is Professor Emeritus in the Department of Rural Sociology here at UW-Madison, soon to be the Department of Community and Environmental Sociology here at UW-Madison. The goal of the series is to bring in eminent scholars who are working in the area of inequality in an international context. And the series started, as I said, in 1990 with our first with the first lecture given by Marta Tienda, and it has continued ever since. This is the first year, however, that Arch Haller is not actually with us for the lecture. He has some health problems right now, which made it impossible for him to attend. So I want to thank the Haven Center for taping the lecture that we're going to hear today so that he can listen to it at his home in Tucson. I also want to thank the... there is a Haller Lecture Fund that supported this event today. But I also want to thank the UW Lectures Committee and CALS International Foundation or Fund for their supplemental support. And the lecture is sponsored on campus by the Department of Rural Sociology, the Department of Sociology, and the Division of International Studies. I want to thank all of those units. So now it is my pleasure to introduce the introducer or present the presenter. As this individual just said, it's a tribute to the person who's being introduced if there's a long line of people who have to speak before they do. It's my pleasure to introduce Professor Alejandro Portes, a professor of sociology at Princeton University, the founding director, I believe, there of the Center for Migration and Development at that institution. Professor Portes received his PhD here at UW-Madison, I'll just say, a number of years ago, and he was a student of Arch Haller, and he's been the person really responsible for setting up and promoting, continuing this event. And he has also been the Haller lecturer on at least two occasions. He is a renowned scholar of topics such as the topics of migration, development, and informal economy. And he is going to introduce our speaker for the day.
Well, it's a pleasure to see the Haller Lecture so well attended this year, a tribute to our speaker this year. It's good to be back home, and definitely the only thing to be lamented is that Arch is not with us. He used to come to every round of this event religiously and bring about 20 members of his family as well. I think that it has become, I'm glad that the lecture has become institutionalized and that it has been in every occasion a big event and a successful one. This year, of course, is going to be as or more successful than in prior occasions, given the reputation and the stature of the Haller Distinguished Lecture this year. It is a great pleasure to introduce my friend from so many years and colleague Saskia Sassen, whom I've known we've known each other from the beginning of our careers.
Kindergarten.
And whose trajectory has been really spectacular from Notre Dame University to become really one of the major public intellectuals to come out of the field of sociology, not only in the United States, but worldwide, as her many recognitions throughout the U.S., Europe, and other countries attest. She is now the Robert S. Lynn Professor of Sociology and member of the Committee on Global Thought at Columbia University, that she rejoined after spending 8 years at the University of Chicago. Her famous book, The Global City, has been translated, as of last count, I hear, in 19 languages, and continues to be a standard reference for those interested in the field of urbanization, world system development, and the like. And she has not stopped there. I was talking to her that before we started the event, that perhaps it's time to stop, but she really has no intention to doing so, and is carrying on with the same vigor and intellectual acumen as characterizes her work. Her new books are Territory, Authority, and Rights, From Medieval to Global Assemblages, published by Princeton University Press, and A Sociology of Globalization, published by Norton. And she has just completed a for UNESCO, a 5-year project on sustainable human settlement with a network of researchers and activists in no less in count in 30 countries, which is really a remarkable feat. So I don't need to extend this. We all know who Saskia Sassen is. This is simply to remind you, in case of her many achievements. And please join me in welcoming Professor Sassen.
Thank you very much for such a kind and generous introduction. I'm really delighted to be here. Thank you very much, Professor Jane Collins. It has been a great pleasure to meet you and to meet some of your students. They're somewhere here. Mm-hmm. And I also am very honored to talk, to give this Arch Haller lecture. I keep thinking of him as Archibald O. Haller. That is such a great name, you know? It's sort of that O in the middle. Very good. Yes, just delighted and honored to do this. I want to talk a bit about this latest book of mine. Ah, and that reminds me. I brought a book for the newly named, and I might have been the first one to use this name. It's very long. The Department of Community and Environmental Sociology. Did you know you had such a department? Many of you probably don't know yet, but there it is. So, my pleasure. My engagement with the question of globalization comes in a way from many different directions. One of them is a kind of insatisfaction with the language, with the vocabulary of globalization. One might make that into a question. We are living through some foundational, though partial, transformations. Does the vocabulary of globalization capture all that is really going on in terms of those transformations? Again, foundational but partial. And my answer, my thesis, many, many years ago was no. The vocabulary of globalization does not quite capture all the transformations that are happening. The language of globalization is also an invitation to think of two master categories, the global and the national, as sort of capturing what is going on. We still have the national, it's been around for a long time, and now we have the global. And I've come to see, and I must say this is a bit exposed, you know, it's not that I started out thinking that way, but I can see that over the last, what to me feels like 100 years of research, but it's more like 25, that I have always been sort of engaged with master categories, but looked for what all they obscure. A master category is a master category for good reasons. It contains a lot of explanatory power. It illuminates sharply a lot of things. But in that capacity, in that power, it also creates a vast penumbra around itself. It's like the famous, you know, the light in the street at night, and what surrounds it is even darker than if that light didn't exist. And so I have come to see that my site for field work, for research, is that number. So, and it had the global city, in a way, was a response to the notion that it was a place with economy, space-time compression, hypermobile capital. So my question there was, well, does this highly mobile, electronic, placeless economy ever hit the ground? Does it ever need concentrated, territorial insertions of one sort or another? And my answer was yes, it does, etc. Now, in this case, the engagement really comes with the question of the national in this new version. And if you take a proposition that for me is very important, I invite you to sort of consider it, at least while this talk lasts, that this is a time, this period, this modernity we're living, that started in the 80s, that materialized in the 80s. It was actually under construction probably earlier. But I repeat, if we consider that this modernity is marked by stable meanings or stabilized meanings becoming unstable, and you apply that to these two master categories, the national and the global, you actually begin to open a domain for research, for interpretation, for politics, for theory, that you do not open if you consider that the national and the global capture whatever the character and the features of this transformation, which again for me is a partial transformation but foundational. Now, you know, there are many, many ways of going at it, but I just want to start with a few empirical items so that you begin to get a sense as to where I want to go with it. For instance, we all know that there are a lot of firms that conduct themselves as if they were global. In fact, we call them global firms. I call them global firms as well. In fact, there is no such entity as the legal persona of the global firm. It doesn't exist. Now, most of the globalization literature, you know, and that's not wrong per se, deals with global firms. There they are. You know, they're global firms. It does not interrogate in the direction that I'm interrogating now. In other words, so where does the global firm come from? Was it made? Is there a legal regime? Is there a supranational regime that establishes a new entity that we can call global firm? No, there isn't. And that's a kind of digging operation a bit, if you want, in the shadow that the clarity of global firm produces. It camouflages all or obscures all kinds of stuff that is also happening. So then where does this possibility of a firm that conducts itself as if it were global come from? And it actually comes from the work that national government after national government, like 170 national governments have done over the last 15 years, of a little change here, a little change there, in their law, in certain institutional aspects, in certain regulatory frames. One way of naming that conglomerate of little transformations is to say that they partly denationalize certain institutional settings deep inside the interiority, if you want, of the national, to produce a denationalized space, which if it recurs in country after country after country, in fact produces the possibility of a global firm. When you look at it that way, you recover all kinds of stuff that really makes it messy, complicated, you know, highly variable, because it turns out that each of these governments uses slightly different instrumentalities. Some use more of the legislature and less of the judiciary. Some use more of the executive, etc. You get the picture. So then you open up the question of the global, and in this case, the question of the global as instantiated by a very powerful actor, the global firm, of which, moreover, we know how many there are. There are almost 300,000, if you want. So this is not an ephemeral reality. It's not like global civil society, which I love, but, you know, it's very difficult to nail it down. These global firms, you can actually nail them down. You can go talk to them. You know where to telephone them. Very different from some other global formations. But you realize that it is an operational space and the work of national governments that produces their possibility. Let me take the example further. Formally speaking, very formally speaking, we have only two global laws. Only two. Now again, we know that there is a lot of globality. But this also tells, once you have done that kind of digging, it also tells you that a lot of this globality is not necessarily highly formalized as such. It could nonetheless be part of a formalized reality, like what I just described about the global firm. The global firm itself does not exist as legal persona, but it can operate in a space that has been formalized through partial denationalization by all these governments. Now, I'm dying, we're a small group, to ask you what you think are the two laws that we have. Anybody wants to shout it out or not? Or you don't like this? Any ideas? I'm just curious. This is just to my benefit, not to make you suffer, all right? I'm just simply curious.
The law of the sea?
The law of the sea. That's a very old sea. Mare liberum, yes. Which, by the way, the empires didn't like for themselves. Mm-hmm. Grotius was very brilliant there. That is a kind of, yes, in a way, but not quite. No. Two formal that we have made, because a lot of globalization is made, that is also what I'm getting at, the two global laws we have made, you know, over the last, whatever, two decades or so.
Yes, Professor Zeitlin, yes, give me your answer.
I don't know if you would consider the WTO.
Exactly, yes. Trips through WTO. That is a global law. Now, I will immediately elaborate as to why. So, you see, it's nice to have a professor. Right. Yeah. So, what's the other global law?
Human rights.
You're almost there, but what's the formalized?
UN Declaration of Human Rights.
It is the International Criminal Court. Right. Which, of course. The human rights, you know, human rights law is very ambiguous. Like, for instance, we have not incorporated human rights law in our national law. The UK, the supposedly, you know, the iconic liberal democracy, incorporated human rights law in its national law, but only in 2001. You know, these are things that many people don't realize. These are very short little histories. But the ICC is the International Criminal Court. Now, why are these, and again, WTO through TRIPS and the ICC, why are they global? They're global because they're not like the supranational system. The supranational system means that you go through, and this is the thing with the human rights regime, strictly and legally speaking. You know, your country has to become a signatory to implement it as you can use human rights for interpretation. But yeah, so in the supranational system, the state really represents, the national state represents its collectivity. And a lot of what we call globalization is actually supranational. But it's supranational, the global is in there. I'm not saying that it is not, but I also want to make this distinction. Difference with ICC and WTO law is what? That you can go straight, you can bypass the national state. If it is WTO, you've all heard the cases, a firm can go straight to a lower order court, and for instance, and hundreds of these cases have been made, and make a claim that its free trading rights are being violated because of local environmental regulation. It is not a question of state to state. The same thing with the ICC. We can go straight to a court and make a case against this or that dictator. And right now, in fact, there are several cases being made, as you might know, against some of our politicians. Not the ones who are now in power, you know, but the ones just left. So Rumsfeld, Cheney, I mean, you know, this is often. So those are two formalized global institutions. But a lot of the rest. And we know that there is a lot of other stuff that is part of this transformation. A lot of that is not quite formalized as global in terms of being really distinct from the supranational, from the international, etc. But this is where I go back and I look at these two master categories and say, so what else is happening? Because we know that there is a lot of globality. Now, a lot of what is happening, and this is partly the story in this book, is that that there are little transformations that are happening inside very formal institutions. It could be the executive branch of government, very formal, or that are happening in sort of more diluted civic spaces that are happening in all kinds of, I'll elaborate a bit, but just let me be sort of quick and short right now. And what these processes, events, conditions, interventions represent is a kind of denationalizing of what was historically constructed as national. Now, historically constructed is a serious conditionality in this analysis, okay? Because the national was made. So it was historically constructed as national. Moreover, it is it has enormous historical specificity in the sense that it was constructed with different instrumentalities, under different conditions, by different actors, in different kinds of countries. You can see there is a bit of a constructivist analysis in what I was just saying. But it's also a way, I'm simplifying it just a tad for the sake, you know, of communication. If you then take the next step, and you have to take a next step, which is to interpret these processes of partial, often very particular, often highly specialized, not always immediately evident, denationalizing of what was historically constructed as national. If you interpret these as also part of the transformation that we're living through, then you have really opened up the terrain of that transformation beyond the global, and to me very importantly, beyond the binary of global versus national. And you have opened up, you know, a research agenda, a theorization agenda, and also a political agenda, an agenda for political action, that takes the question of whatever that transformation that we're living through, and no matter how partial it is, to a different domain. It means, for instance, that we need a lot of ethnography deep inside national institutions in order to mark with clarity and detail part of, not all of it, part of what right now is either easily talked about in the language of globalization or is simply forgotten or obscured by the fact that we have the global as the category that captures all the oxygen, if you want, of this notion of a foundational transformation. I hope that you're still with me. It also means politically that citizens still confined to the national for the execution of most of their rights, can actually engage in global politics from the space, and I'll give you some examples, of the national. You don't have to go global, you don't even have to go to a global court to do global politics. So it alters the notion also of the political in this current period. Most citizens are immobile. For whatever reason, they're too poor, they're too lazy, they have too many children, they're persecuted, if they leave their country, they can't get back in, whatever. So the notion that immobility does not preclude participation in global politics, it is sort of a different kind of political algorithm, if you want, for the current period, than the notion that if the transformation is about globalization, and if you can't go to a global level, you're out of that kind of politics. You can keep on doing local politics, national politics. So, and again, there is, you know, in this book that I worked on for years, there's a lot of stuff, very boring book, but I'm just giving you a bit of shorthand here about what all of this is about. Now, let me then put out here a kind of a proposition, if you want. And that is that rather than looking at these transformations in terms of global versus national, this binary that has really dominated a lot of the debate and a lot of the research about globalization, a binary that contains with it a thesis about mutual exclusivity and also an interaction effect whereby what the global wins, the national loses, what the national wins, the global loses. It's sort of zero sum. Which, of course, also leads to notions that if the state today is getting more involved in the economy, we are deglobalizing. Well, let me just give you, just to problematize that, and to show that this binary is not very helpful. That money that they're taking from taxpayers and putting into rescuing banks, yes, the state is organizing that. Right? That is often interpreted as a return to nationalisms, as a deglobalizing. But if you look very carefully, it is the state, government, executive, the legislature, whatever, taking national taxpayers' money to rescue the global system. Is that nationalism? I don't know. It problematizes the notion of nationalism, the return to nationalism. Citicorp, just to mention a familiar bank, is not really an American bank. We have given it a lot of money. Citicorp, at least 30% of Citicorp is owned by sovereign funds, which are mostly in Muslim countries, actually, in this case, which I also find sort of an interesting proposition because of the prior regime, you know, and its problems with the Muslim world, slash terrorism, all of that. Then there's another 30% that is owned by who knows what, investors from. Then there are some that might be listed as American investors. But, you know, they also, they are, just because they are American and live here and have U.S. citizenship, does not necessarily mean that they're simply American investors. They own stuff from all over the world. So, is this nationalism as we used to know it? No. This is, for me, a kind of a denationalized intervention by a national state. And you see more and more of that. So, this binary, it's either national or global, is, I think, unsettled, made unstable conceptually by the fact that a lot of what looks as if it is a return to nationalism or a national government, actually, when you look very carefully, it's a whole mix of things. And I have produced a list sort of things that of conditions that show to what extent the executive branch of government increasingly over the last 20 years was located and enacted, in fact, global logics. And in terms of location on a global, in a global zone, for instance, the global regulators, the IMF, the World Bank, they only deal with the executive branch of government. So that means that the more the IMF, and this is the story of the last 20 years, of course, because right now the IMF is broke and WTO is more or less in pieces, you know, so they've done their work, however. So when the IMF and the WTO dealt with countries, and the more involved they got, the more some aspect of the national, of the executive branch of government, gained power. When you privatize economic sectors, which is the story of neoliberalism over the last 20 years, you are indeed, a lot of writing about this, a lot of research, you are taking out functions from the legislature, oversight functions. You privatize it, you relocate something in the domain of the market. So the oversight functions of the legislature are thereby partly eliminated. Right? Whereas when it was in the public domain, it was more its direct regulation. Now, what has been left out of the picture by a lot of this research is the fact that even as that was happening, there was another circuit that developed, which was the setting up of specialized commissions, regulatory commissions, actually, inside the executive branch of government, but outside the legislature, which were in charge. You had one on communications, one on environment, the famous Cheney Commission, you may recall, one on finance, etc., which were mostly staffed, of course, by people from the sectors, plus executive branch appointees. Now, then again, well, whereas the typical notion is that the privatizing that came with neoliberalism weakened the state, if you actually see what happened and you desegregate the state, you see that some of that, it weakened the legislature, but it actually strengthened the power of the executive. And then finally, at the most general level, we all know that central banks, ministries of finance, they all gained power because of globalization. So that kind of stuff, those empirical facts, problematize the notion of this binary global national, the notion that what the national loses, the global wins, the notion that if the executive branch of government is involved, or the central bank is involved, or the Ministry of Finance is involved, that we're dealing with nationalism. I really think that that binary that has operated as a master category has really sort of obscured all kinds of other things that happen. Now, I could go on and on with all the little details of these transformations that I've given you, but you know, there is a limit, I know. But I hope that I made the point that there is enough sort of divergence, if you want, inside the state apparatus. I said that some things, you know, the legislator lost, but the executive branch of government won, that you can see what I mean by this unsettling, if you want, of the notion of the global and the national as two wholes, which are in this mutually exclusive, zero-sum connection. Now, one way of thinking, and I want to give you a simple example to sort of the next leg, if you want. One simple way of thinking about these transformations, well, simple, it's not so simple, but you know what I mean, is to say that whereas time one, the time of the rise of the nation state, territory, authority, and rights, three foundational elements, all sort of had a dynamic, if you want, of the formation of a unitary system, aggregating around the center held, never perfectly, and very diverse ways across the world. The notion is some sort of centripetality. And that what's happening today, one way of understanding, for example, this divergence between the legislature and the executive branch of government in terms of power. The legislature loses because of corporate economic globalization, the executive branch of government actually gains. One way of looking at that is to, rather than taking the unitary assemblage of territory, authority, and rights that the nation state represents, and without denying that that continues to be a dominant formation, absolutely dominant, that within that formation, there are also new kinds of partial assemblages that happen. And that this is part of the transformation. Can we call this globalization? No. We need a name for it. And there, you know, the question of vocabulary and language. I who grew up in five languages and don't speak one language well, for me the zone of language is also a zone for experimenting. And I very much feel for it sometimes, and in a lot of my research, the absence of a vocabulary that I can use. So now I want to sort of back in that, on that imagery, backtrack and give you a very simple example that connects with very familiar issues. For instance, if we wanted to think about different ways, this is an illustration of how the subject that we call the immigrant gets constituted. And I want you to think in terms of a space, institutional additions. And we look, for instance, this is probably where it comes out clearest, with some of these, like the new transnational class of professionals, which through the WTO, through the free trading regimes, gain portable rights. They are migrants. We don't call them migrants, but they are migrants. But they're migrants who now have portable, formalized rights that they gain out of the free trade agreement. So if I were looking at the space, the assemblage of elements that produces the subject, that is this transnational worker, this professional, who has portable rights, it includes, as one of the elements, the free trading system. Now, if you look at any, I don't know how many of you, but I know that some of you do look. If you look at the main trade, say NAFTA, WTO, if you look at these trading books, you know, they don't talk about migrants, they just don't. Each chapter, you know, delivery of services, etc. But each chapter actually contains, of the core chapters, contains a mini-migration policy, which grants rights to these people. They have term rights. They cannot run, I mean, there's certain things that they can't do, and they wouldn't want to do. But so when you look at the assemblage of elements, the bits of territory, authority, and rights that get assembled in country after country, because that's the other thing, and that produces this transnational class of professionals, because they need that infrastructure, otherwise it don't exist. You compare that with a contract labor worker who enters for seasonal work in specific short-term conditions, a very different set of conditions, but the conditions are also there. And then you can take, you know, the business visa, immigrant, the family. Each of these is a subject. Besides the fact, here I have sort of the other version is the subject, that's an easier way to look at it. But in this case, emphasizing the spaces, what are the elements that need to come together? When you begin to look at a whole variety of relations through these terms, you keep engaging, you know, the institutional frames of both the global and the national. And they sort of get mixed up. I talked a little about that same thing with the global firm, right? But this is again a different one. Now, I must say that I find that also the question here, I'm just using immigrants, but I think that the question of the citizen is also changing in that sense. Can people, I'm not speaking very loud because I have a bit of a, I think this is a, what do we call that, allergy ear time here? Because I've been attacked, my eyes and my nose and my throat. But you can hear me in the back? Because I realize I could be talking more. But the subject that is the citizen, if you redeploy that subject, also out of its formal frame, the citizen, the rights-carrying subject that is a foundational member, foundational institution for membership in the liberal democracy. If you try to understand, like those who do research on citizenship, if you try to sort of try to get at questions, who is the rights-bearing subject today? Given growing inequality, given disenfranchisement, all these other conditions are happening. And if you sort of took, you know, that bull by the horns, so to say, who is the rights-bearing citizen? And you try to redeploy that subject, the figure, across the multiple legal systems, specialized technical systems that constitute it, you also get some very interesting. You mentioned the human rights before, right? There are regimes that the citizen today can invoke that do not belong to the national. At the same time, inside of the national, if you take the United States, there are two opposing tendencies. One is the rights that we carry, and they're great rights to have, and it's wonderful to have them and all of that. But on the other hand, attacks on those rights as well. And not just because of the state of exception, but because of certain issues that have to do with neoliberalism. And maybe I should just elaborate that a bit, because it is a good sort of example. And if you are, let's just think United States. If you are a welfare recipient in the United States today, chances are you don't deal with the state. You deal with the private management agency. Or if you are in prison in a privately run jail, you don't interact with the state. You interact with a firm. In fact, a firm that thinks of it as, I have to fill the beds in this motel, so give me your prisoners. Right now, New York City has a crisis because it has more privately managed prisons, more empty beds, than it has prisoners. So that citizen is in a very peculiar situation. And in fact, there have been some very interesting lawsuits. We might want to return to that if there's anybody who's really interested in that during discussion. Very interesting lawsuits that are beginning to problematize who are the wardens in these prisons? Are they employees of the state? Do they have the protection of federal employees? In fact, one of these cases went to the Supreme Court, very famous case, and the Supreme Court was totally divided. So these are these sort of no zones. Now, back to another aspect of the citizen, I have been looking at the rights that we lose. The rights that we are citizens, not under the state of exception, because that's sort of an exceptional state, you know, the state presumes, but just in the regular run of matters in this era of neoliberalism. This is another way of getting at these transformations inside the national that are part of the transformation. But I just mentioned about the privatizing of prisons and the privatizing of welfare, the intermediaries, is part of this neoliberalism. And it lengthens the distance between the state and the citizen. Now, here's another set of examples, and that affects sort of all of us. We are losing rights. I don't know if people know this. You may not be directly affected. Last year, we lost 3 rights. Again, I'm dying to ask you, do you know what rights you lost? But sooner or later, you'll run into that. And some people, of course, are already running into it. Now, here I have to tell you a story. So my husband, who is an American, always says that I work too hard and I should get a hobby. Now, if you grew up in Latin America, I don't know if you ever do, Alejandro, but hobby is a very ambiguous term. You know, hobby, you don't really know what a hobby is. And so I remember in 1996, Clinton was president, Democratic president, Democratic Party president is probably a better language, and he passed a new Immigration Reform and Control Act, Some of you may remember that. And that I lost, we as citizens lost a right, not just the immigrants, they lost a pile of rights, but we, the citizens too, we lost the right to sue the Immigration and Naturalization Service in a lower order court, lower order court being the court where we have legal standing. We can launch a lawsuit. Federal court, totally different. So I remember I went to my husband and I said, Richard, I have a hobby. I'm counting all the rights that I'm losing as a citizen in this country. That's not a hobby. Anyhow, I've been counting those rights. It's really amazing. And of course, what happens here, coming back to some of rethinking these subjects, you know, the subjects that the language that we have used, the citizen, the immigrant, the transnational professional, the contract, the subject has sort of a completeness is suggested conceptually and politically. So, but if you look at our law, we are not like, a Christmas tree with all the bubbles. And so if one bubble disappears, you know, aha, I've lost a right. No, it doesn't work that way. We don't exist. We exist in certain elements, you know, the foundational or whatever. But our rights are distributed across multiple technical fields. And to reconstruct the rights-bearing subject out of all of that stuff is actually very arduous work. And that is why it is so difficult to detect, actually, when you've lost a right. Now, I think that these rights that we're losing, for instance, one right, just to illustrate the technicality of it, one of the rights that we lost last year was that the credit cards, those wonderful things, the credit cards, which had been trying this for a very long time, the credit rights now, and only they, not your neighbor, they now have the right to pierce through the wall of bankruptcy. You know, when you declare bankruptcy, the purpose of the law, whether a firm or household, is to give you a chance to recover. So an invisible wall goes up around you. The credit cards have gained last year the right to pierce through that wall and to go, so to speak, after your last dollar. Now, not your neighbor. Your neighbor, you may owe your neighbor $1,000. You never can. Nor can the average firm with little grocery. No. Credit cards. So, many of us are not affected by that because we're not about to declare bankruptcy. But actually, with a crisis, you know what? It moves up into the middle classes. So, bankruptcy law is no longer the full protector. Insofar as we're more and more dependent on credit cards, it actually makes a difference. Another right we lost is the right to launch. Remember the tobacco action? Class action lawsuits in the lower order court. Now, true, there usually is a barracuda lawyer who said, I'll do this for you. But still, some of these are citizen initiated. We've lost that. But we lose it through something that is called the Criminal Lawyers Act. You see, so we don't recognize it as something we lost. But anyhow, the point that I'm trying to make here is that if you look at these spaces within which the subject is produced, and then see how those spaces themselves are changing, and hence that reflects directly or indirectly, you know, you begin to have sort of a different view. Now, what I'm particularly interested in are those that link either to neoliberalism, quite a few of these losses of rights have to do with that, and those that link with the global. Those that even the citizen is altered as a rights-carrying subject in a way that involves non-national elements, even though we think of citizenship as a purely national, subject. And now here, I want to give you a second example of something that. I have to look at the clock here. So, do people recall the Danish? You know, profit. I was thinking either in Spanish, profeta. You know that this. For those of you who are students in English. That is misspelled, all right? And I'm amazed that whatever it is, the system didn't mark it in red. But it should be PH. But Dutch or Spanish, you do just an F, and clearly I was in that zone. Now, you may recall that these caricatures came out. They were caricatures of the Putin Islam. They came out in a Danish newspaper. There was a bit of sort of to and fro diplomatically and this and that. But not much else. There was a bit of twittering and there was a bit of diplomacy. And what I want to say next, and this is just my phrase here, I want to frame it in terms of two positives, because the stuff then eventually when it explodes becomes very, very messy. In order to create some discipline for me as an observer, I just want to isolate two positives out of this very, very messy landscape. And so let's say that the debate was framed in terms of the right to freedom of expression, you know, which is, we in the West think of this as one of the highest, you know, versus respect for religions. Now, mind you, on the ground, when the debate exploded, it went way beyond these two. Now, what I want to point out is that a larger assemblage was shaped, which meant that it went well beyond, the event eventually goes well beyond this binary, right? So each one of the critical elements, religion and law, was unsettled. They ceased having stable meanings. Both acquired political and sociological meanings. I remember I was writing something for opendemocracy.net about this, and I said that what the West did, and often with very good intentions, the West, I should say, certain Western journalists, etc., were really keen on the freedom of expression and all of that, you know, which is a very powerful right and a very important right. I don't want to minimize it. But they insisted on the law, the fact that this is a law, hence it is legal to do these caricatures. Now, that is where it becomes just a bit more dubious, that this law was no longer simply a law. It really became part of a much larger dynamic. And the same thing with religion. So, as you probably know, do I have that here or not? No. So, the BBC, I'm missing a slide here, 6 months after the cartoons were published, many of you know this, I'm sure, the BBC, and it sort of went well with just a little wrinkle, but then the BBC, a global news organization, made a story about it, a story about the cartoons and the debate, and then it was an explosion on both sides. So there were French, I remember there's this one French journal that was going broke, right-wing journal, that decided to publish the cartoons. Mind you, they ceased being broke. You can understand how that went. So clearly, this was not just simply freedom of expression, all kinds of other things. And also the fact that when the BBC comes in, then the global Muslim networks, which, you know, the global Muslim network that then gets active is a whole mix of things. It's an assemblage of elements. And in that sense, these two elements are much more than just that original, you know, juxtaposition. And this, to me, is also a mini microcosm of some of these other, you know, binaries that sort of are very stylized, but they don't quite work that way. Now, I want to, in the last 10 minutes or so that I want to talk now, I want to begin to look at a more complex version of this argument that I'm making, that part of the transformation is a reassembling, if you want, or a disassembling of the national unitary assemblage, and then a proliferation of little assemblages, that slightly reorder, reposition, and recode in terms of national versus denationalized in this case. You know, bits and pieces of territory, authority and rights. Now, one sort of, if you want, there are two organizing logics at work here, if you take a broader, more synthetic thing. One is a centripetal scaling of the modern nation state, marked by a master normativity, sort of a master concept. You know, the source of authority, the source of legitimacy is the state, etc., and sort of the tendency is towards that. Even countries with massive imperial geographies have this. And then there is another one emerging, which is centrifugalities. So that things, I would say that the privatizing that I talked about of the welfare state, the privatizing of the prisons, the loss of rights by citizens, which grows the distance between the citizen and the state. What I was talking about, the two global laws, you know, a lot of this stuff is marked by centrifugalities. It doesn't mean that it physically leaves the national, but it exits that formalized encasement. And I should also just backtrack a bit and say that when I was doing this research, trying to get away from global and national, I alluded to this at the beginning, I had to find another conceptual foothold from which to deal with these complex formations, because it is not just a question, you know, these are not simple elements. And so I chose, but I also say in the book, you know, others can choose others, I chose territory, authority, and rights. Three foundational elements to any complex organization formally. Tribal, imperial, national, and probably a whole variety of other ones. And as I said, you can add a few others. They're both sort of trans-historical. They exist in all this organization. And they are very historical. They assume different contexts, different meanings, different kinds of formalizations, and importantly, different interactions in different settings. Think of European medieval times. I had a lot of fun, I must say, working with the medieval historiographies. But in medieval times, actually let me backtrack, in national, in the nation state, territory is the dominant of both things. Out of exclusive authority over territory, the national state gains multiple added capacities. It gains its authority from that and the capacity to declare this legitimate and that illegitimate and the capacity, of course, to provide rights, the guarantor of rights, the giver of rights, the source of law, if you want. In medieval times, territory was not dominant. It was authority, and a given territory was subject to multiple systems of authority. In church, the manor, whatever, the empire, whatever. So, and then when I look now at the global, I try to understand, you know, how do they interact? What is dominant? I ask myself, for example, what is dominant, if I look at these three, in electronic markets, in finance? It's not territory. It is authority, in my interpretation. Now, I can't now defend that interpretation, right? But I'm just telling you that. Oh, does this mean it's going to sleep?
You mean your batteries?
Yeah, that could also be the case. Now, I had a whole series of other things, so very quickly, I have to stop. So I want to just show you three ways of, I mean, actually, I have four cases, but I may not get to it, ways in which, again, take further this alternative conceptualizing, which is very partial, by the way, of in terms of assemblages. So one of them is these new jurisdictional geographies. Now, I don't want to look at the ICC, because we already all know what this is about. I want to give you another... Yeah, there it goes. Okay. This is a very old little traveling laptop. All right. And I just want to give you an example. If you just shut up, we're fine now, as opposed to making all kinds of other noises. But I want to just give you an example that some of you probably know, but there is a lot of this happening. And I want to invite you to pay attention to the component pieces of it. Because it really marks a very interesting combination that to me fits this notion of assemblage. And so these are a series of lawsuits that were launched against multinational corporations, not just American multinational corporations. There were French, British, German, etc. Here is the first element that I want to point out. These were lawsuits launched in national courts, in lower order courts. In other words, the local moment of our judiciary system. Very important. They used a national law, not an international law, because really there is very little international law that can be used with things. So the important part is that they could use a national law to launch a lawsuit with global jurisdiction. So one side, I'm just thinking now of one, just to simplify the example. One side was the headquarters of these multinationals, which included several countries. So you already have an element of a global jurisdiction. And the second outside, if you want, foreign site was the offshore operations of these multinationals. At that point, the human rights law kicks in. Because then the lawsuit, the substantive rationality of the lawsuit was for violations against the human rights of workers. You need some sort of framing like that. No? Now, national law, in other words, they did not use a global law really. They invoked for substantive meaning the human rights regime. But the law that really made it happen was national law. So I'm sure that many of you know that. The national law was the Alien Tort Claims Act. This is one of the oldest laws. You know, it's almost 300 years old. And for 200 years, it was not used. But when it was used, it comes out of the term piracy. The pirates. And that means that any country that has a history of piracy, you know, chances are they have some law like that. The legal system is very enormously. So they could do the same thing, that in principle the idea. Now, the pirate of today is the multinational corporation, you know, which I also think is sort of a nice idea. Now, that means that national citizens went to a lower order court, used a national law to make the global jurisdiction. Because these types of jurisdictions had not been made before. Because, you know, the thing about the powerful law is that you can make a jurisdiction. You know, a jurisdiction is a system of authority, basically, right? So, you know, as I go now around the world talking about some of these issues, I always say, check out your old laws. A law is a public good. A law comes out of it. In the same way that international commercial arbitration, which is a private system of law, uses mostly New York State commercial law, a public good, but in a totally private setting. So I had for a while a research assistant who kept saying, but this is a public law, this is not a private system. I said, no, they're using a public good for a very privatized system. You know, international commercial arbitration has nothing to do with national arbitration courts. It is really a private, it's sort of an agreement, it's a profoundly sociological condition. So there is quite a bit of this kind of stuff happening today, and it represents a mix. Now the second case I was going to talk about, and I don't know that I think I should be starting to end here, the second case is the notion of the financial center. Now the financial center and the most powerful globalized electronic sectors, they need these, you know, the global city function, if you want. Financial center is a very interesting case, because the financial center is deeply embedded in a subnational space, the city. The financial center is marked by thick localisms. The financial center is not just, you know, there are traders, there are sort of a lot of old histories that are still at work. There are interpretations. The financial center is a site where many localized or national interpretations about what is a great investment sort of come together. And the national center becomes, in the global era, the place where these globalized actors also hit the ground. And then a kind of cultural work happens in these financial centers, which is how do the globalized sectors persuade the localized, sort of the gatekeepers, if you want, that this is a good investment. I'm simplifying the story a bit, but a lot of it's happening. So it turns out that while from a distance you might think of the financial center of the site, the ultimate high expertise and the most advanced machinery to do all that electronic stuff, actually it is a kind of a frontier space. By frontier space, I mean a space where two actors from different worlds, in this case a transnational financial sort of models, which are pretty standardized in many ways, and this very localized sort of thick, particularized environment of the local traders. They encounter each other in the financial center. And the financial center is a frontier space in my sort of conceptualization, because these two actors do not have, their encounter is not rule by established norms for engagement. It's a free zone. Now, we know that the globalizers won that battle, that they managed to put, and now we have the benefit of this incredible financial crisis, right? So again, the financial center is not simply national, nor is it global. It is a mix of elements. It's a space that is, again, in my lingual sort of, partly denationalized. Now the third and very quickly final example I want to talk about is the question of global civil society. And I want to make some very, very quick observations here. And I want to take you to the limit case, not the usual nice, fuzzy, easy, whatever, global civil society with all its incredibly attractive virtues. I want to talk about immobile activists who are not cosmopolitan at all, who are obsessives, say they're in human rights, they're obsessed with a torturer in their jail, not with torture. Or environmental activists who are obsessed with the factory that is polluting their water, not just with the environmental challenge. And I want to raise then the question, can these local ones, immobile, you know, thick localisms, non-cosmopolitan activists, can they constitute globalities? Because again, I'm talking about immobility means pushing the conceptual limit, you see? Because if it's global, if it's transnational, if it's post-national, you know, that's sort of easier in a way. And I argue that under certain conditions, yes, they do constitute globalities. Now, the way they constitute the globality is a mix of a new sort of subjective ideational space that has also come into existence. And the recurrence, repetition of what they're about, what they represent, country after country after country after country. So that mix with this ideational space where they become aware of that, a disposition towards the global. You know, a lot of the literature on transnationalism and on post-nationalism really gets at those kinds of issues that are more subjective. They are a disposition. The people themselves are still stuck, if you want, very often in very thick national environments, it may be two national environments. So there is a subjective dimension, I think, that the current period also brings to the fore. Very difficult to make legible, very difficult to capture. Very often the capture is what? Cosmopolitanism, post-nationalism. I'm interested, so I totally accept that. I have no problem with that, you know. I like it, all of that. But what, and that is why looking at the immobile, at the non-cosmopolitan, sort of the extreme condition that forces you to develop an instrument in order, or analytic instruments if you want to capture this. And so the thing that I have sort of from a bit getting around studying this, also in this UNESCO effort, there is a kind of awareness. You know, I'm not alone in this. There are others who are exactly the same. And it is not necessarily becoming cosmopolitan. Now, then I ask myself a question. What would the great cosmopolitan organizations, Amnesty International, Oxfam, they're really great organizations. Their elites, I mean, not their elites, their membership, their leaders, are enormously cosmopolitan, and they're highly mobile, right? So I know that I sound like I said, just with a tad of irony, but it's just a tad, all right? I really believe that we need those organizations. But I ask myself, what would they be without these non-cosmopolitan, you know, provincialized, if you want, localized, obsessive people. I think they would be in trouble. And that again opens up for me the space, you know, of it's not either global or national or cosmopolitan versus or against. There is something else that is happening and what this period makes possible. And I want to end with an element that comes, a datum that I think everybody should know, but almost nobody seems to know. Well, this room might be an exception, which has to do with the new constitutions, the constitutions that were done in Latin America after the military dictatorships, in South Africa after apartheid, in East and Central Europe, in the post-Soviet era, and that's about it, I guess, right? And these constitutions were all sort of shaped in the late 80s and in the 90s. And these constitutions have a clause that varies in length and in detail, you know, across countries. Like the Brazilians have really elaborated that clause because they are dealing with Afro-Brazilians, with issues of women, with all kinds of things. And others, like the Polish constitution, is very short. Now the clause, and I'm giving you my language, my sort of synthetic language to capture the central idea of the clause. The clause basically says that the sovereign is the language of the state, you know, in international law and international forum. But the sovereign, even if legitimate, democratically elected, whatever, even if legitimate, cannot presume to be the exclusive representative of its people in an international forum. Now, clearly behind that lies indigenous people who have long wanted, long before this constitution, direct representation in international forum. Behind that also lies apartheid. Africans did not feel their state, represent South Africa, represent. And frankly, when the war on Iraq came, you know, there was this movement, not in my name, I was part of it, you know, not in my name, the state. Now, these are all elements, and the new constitutions are the most formalized elements that signal a change. It's a partial change, but it is foundation. It is a rupture with what is the great achievement of the French and American constitutions, which is to say the state are the people, sovereign are the people are the sovereign. In other words, the sovereign is no longer divine. Come down, sovereign. Now we're in a different zone. And whether it is formalized as in these constitutions or not formalized as not in my name movements, we are saying, sovereign, you do not necessarily represent the collectivity. You do not represent me. And to me, that is one, you know, besides the two global laws that I talked about at the beginning, this is one other formalized element that captures a change. And what is astounding to me in all of these elements that I mentioned, whether these three formalized elements or the more informalized elements that I have alluded to, they all are partial. They all are not necessarily in your face visible. They're not like the IMF as the instance of the global, WTO as the instance of the global. They are of a different sort. Now, they don't. It doesn't preclude the existence of these other sort of in-your-face globalization. But these are different. They are much more elusive, and in a way, to me as a sociologist, they are a profound sociological challenge in terms of research. And I leave you with that very happy thought. Thank you very much.